Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to Screen Talk, IndieWire's weekly podcast. I'm Eric Cohn, the deputy editor and chief critic, joined as always by our editor at large, Anne Thompson. And we are starting the conversation this week with some actual Oscar news, or at least Academy news, because the Academy, as it does every year, announced a bunch of people it was letting in. We knew they'd be leaning into diversity. We didn't know the insane volume of people, the floodgates would be truly opening this year. What do you make of the huge volume of new Academy.
It is remarkable. I mean, if you go back to 2015, they were, you know, the usual level of people was like 300 and something across all the branches. And then it went up after Oscar So White in 2016, it went up to like 600 and something. And then last year it was 700 and something. And this year it was 928. Which is, I mean, just for those of us who are trying to look through all the names, it's an enormously long list. And it brings, if they all accept, which they don't always do, Ryan Coogler is a notable example of someone who decided not to join. Ironically, though, I mean, Black Panther could do very well this year with the new membership. And that's the question, is whether, you know, if you get up to about 8,200 people and a certain percentage of them are international and people of color and women and all of these changes adding up over these past 3 years, it may make a difference now.
It's very interesting to think about it, because a lot of times with these announcements, I mean, people are caught off guard by them. And it's bringing people into the conversation who you don't automatically associate with the kind of process of award season campaigning. And to see some of these names on there, whether it's, you know, Sean Baker, Chloe Zhao, or Justin Simeon, I think what's interesting about those people is that they're fairly newcomers to the scene, but in some ways kind of epitomize the direction it's going and the likelihood that this means a broader range of films, not just in terms of the diversity side of things, but in terms of smaller films, independently produced films, really are kind of the standard now in terms
of
award
season. Well, don't get ahead of yourself, Eric.
I want to. That's what I want to see happen.
A lot of people want to say, oh, this is, you know, this is going to mean it's going to go totally indie and or foreign, or, you know, now you can get, I mean, you could before, you could get a Moore. You could get Michael Haneke's Amour, which was a huge success, but it had to be. It had to be a success in America. It had to be seen by all those voters. It had to, you know, even if it's going to be interesting, because they're sending things out through a mailing house or through a bunch of mailing houses now, so that the different publicists, like Peggy Siegel's List, is less, you know, important than it used to be. It has to go out. So the DVDs are going to go out to these people all over the world, but that doesn't mean they're going to watch them. And it doesn't mean that something arcane and small is still going to have a chance with that bigger group. Even if you were to say that maybe 20% of the Academy, which is what I did a sort of rough estimate based on all the numbers and names I have of the Academy membership is now international, which is pretty significant. But if you look at those numbers, it's still like, you know, you'd have maybe 1,700 people who are from all around the world, and you would still have 700 and something people who are basically domestic.
Well, look, I'm not saying...
You still have to reach all those people.
Yeah.
It isn't going to make... You know, remember, Darkest Hour still got 6 nominations.
I mean, I'm not saying that the old rules are completely gone. We say this about politics too. It's like, just because things are changing doesn't mean that there aren't some old tricks that still kind of run the game. And it's not like studios have been completely run out of town. if the voting happened right now.
Well, the studios aren't making that many movies.
But if the voting happened right now, you know that Black Panther
does have a chance. Yeah, that's exciting.
If voting happened right now, Black Panther would be the front runner. We know that, but we also are way early and haven't seen all these movies happening in the fall. What I think is kind of interesting is, yes, it's true that for a long period of time, movies like Amour, if they are commercially successful, have that possibility of crossing over, and you can campaign for that. What I think is kind of compelling to me is this notion that maybe not this year, but sometime in the near future, we may see with this new membership that sensibility kind of bleeding out further beyond that to explore a broader range of films. I also think it's kind of funny to see the foreign directors who are being brought in. You know, people like Lee Chang-dong or odd ones like Bellatar.
Oh, that movie just got picked up. Did you see that?
His film Burning out of Cannes just got picked up. But Bellatar has been retired for years.
I know. I think that's hilarious.
So you
that's
see
like
these
an
names
example
on here, and it's
of
like,
somebody who's not even active anymore. But he's well-deserving. He should
be
in
there.
It's
cool to see that name there. I'm just thinking, you know, look at what if Bellatar?
There's a bigger Asia block, by the way.
Yeah,
a much bigger Asia block, a bigger
level,
Spanish-speaking block.
Appropriately
example.
So. I mean, there's Spanish language cinema is really important on the international stage now. But I think there's also something to be said for just how much these kind of international sensibilities could pervade the Academy, even if they are still in the minority, because
it's more likely
more
to be on the craft side, because that's where they are, most of them, or on the brainy director, writer, editor side.
Yeah,
you know,
that's great.
I'm saying it's going to have an impact, but it's not going to be as dramatic. I would say this, that it's more likely to have an impact on a wider range of genres being acceptable, so that
horror,
it isn't just period dramas like Darkest Hour. It's also perhaps Hereditary or First Reformed or something, you know, a little more edgy that would be more acceptable to them now.
Yeah, and that kind of thing.
Like Shape of Water was.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that kind of thing is really fascinating too, because these films were not produced in Hollywood, but they are successful. They're not successful in like a Black Panther sort of way, but they're successful in a limited release sort of way that seems to be kind of
it needs to be some. I mean, Won't You Be My Neighbor is another example of something that's just reaching a certain kind of critical mass that will make it pretty hard to ignore.
Right. So there's still this need for some kind of a commercial sustainability to drive the campaign itself. I also think it's interesting to think about how foreign language films might be supported in other categories. I mean, the idea of, say,
well, it was true of Amour
getting a cinematography nomination, something like that.
Well, that's happened before with his, what was the name of his
Ida.
Other film, the black and white one?
With Ida.
Yeah, no, that's obviously the Polish filmmaker whose Cold War is coming
yeah,
up.
Yeah, yeah, I was saying Cold War is
what's
a cinematography contender.
What's the name of the Michael Haneke
with
black
Haneke's
and white
film
movie.
Was White Ribbon. So
that's
that,
right.
got, a
that got a cinematography
nomination. Right.
Yeah, no, but Guillermo del Toro has been in there before too with Pan's Labyrinth. That happens. I'm thinking it could have, for example, suppose Cold War did register really well and do well. Maybe it would give the young, I think her name is Joanna Kruger, the young star of the movie.
Yeah, the best actress.
She could be, someone who would have a better chance than she might have before. I mean, just for the sake of argument.
Right, as it should be, if indeed that is one of the best performances of the year. I mean, it's certainly very strong. And if people are seeing it anyway to consider the film for one category, why not others? The other thing to think about in that respect is, are there opportunities for foreign language films that aren't the ones their countries submit?
Yeah, but again, it would have to be, this is the argument I'm making, it would have to be a much more popular movie. You know, it would have to still, even Ida, to use that as an example, like
that was actually
Amour
very successful, yeah.
was a very successful movie. It played, and a movie like Tony Erdmann, which, you know, one did a lot of got a lot of awards from the European Film Awards and was very successful in Europe. It didn't register here. It got put in by the foreign branch, but it wasn't a big. It didn't win foreign language.
It wasn't a movie for everyone. To be fair,
no.
So that was. I mean, it was a hard sell.
Even if it's going to have a remake, which I actually, some people get so annoyed.
It is annoying.
That this could be, her name is Joanna Kulig, K-U-L-I-G. I knew I didn't have it right. Kulig. I will memorize this name, I swear to God.
You'll be sick of it in a couple months.
All right, well, let's move on to one of the new movies coming up this week, which is an interesting case of a filmmaker who got a lot of attention for her last movie, which was 8 years ago, her last feature film, Deborah Granik's Leave No Trace. This played Sundance, and it played Cannes, and well-deserved reviews, very, very, very well reviewed. And yet I worry that despite Bleeker's best efforts and Ben Foster, who did well in Hell or High Water in the movie, I worry that it's a serious, uncompromising look at survivalists in the wild who run against culture.
I suppose so. I wouldn't say
back in. I wonder if how dramatically commercial it will be.
I think in some ways. I mean, I don't know if it's necessarily it's going to get there in the way that Winner's Bone did, but it does seem to me like a less dreary film than Winner's Bone. I mean, Winner's Bone was essentially a detective story, but it was also a movie that, you know, took place against this really bleak backdrop.
Hardscrabble. Yeah.
Yeah. And it just and this one I think is actually more about kind of the quest for a utopian existence outside of modern society. And in that sense it's kind of more hopeful in a way, and it's gentler.
It's a father-daughter drama,
yeah.
And it's very moving and very emotional.
Whereas in Winter's
she
Bone,
discovers
the
a new
missing.
Actress, Thomason, is this girl is super, super good,
Mackenzie.
Who was also, she discovered Jennifer Lawrence with Mitchell.
Exactly. I think the films do speak to each other in a way. I wouldn't put this, unfortunately, because it's been so long since Winter's Bone, it doesn't, I think, benefit from the comparison because it is a smaller film in certain ways. It's not quite as, to me, it wasn't quite as audacious as Winter's Bone. I think Winter's Bone it sort of depicts a society in a more unvarnished way, and this one is trying to kind of bring you along on a journey that's a little bit more conventional in terms of its formula, but it's still very well acted, and there's a lot of intrigue and interesting questions that it asks about family and lifestyle choices and things like that. But
I think what they share, and I think this is what Granik brings to it, is an incredible verisimilitude. I mean, she goes really far with the details and the research and the kind of neorealist ethic, you know, that she's trying to get across. She's really trying to get you to be part of the real world at the same time that she's crafting a drama. And I give her a lot of credit for that. She's a good director, a really good director. The
action. She should make movies more often. I mean, that's sort of the takeaway.
Well, that's a question of the people, not. I mean, she developed many things for HBO, for other indies. She made one documentary, Stray Dog, but that's up to the funders who don't think that she's got a commercial bone in her body, and maybe she doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is,
she's uncompromising.
She's uncompromising, but Winter's Bone did really well, and she's not an experimental filmmaker. She's working in a narrative context with, you know, characters who go on emotional journeys, and there is something fundamentally commercial about what she's doing relative to a lot of people who just stay outside of the system. She has a very particular style and vision, and she's not making big movies and sweeping stories and so forth. But I also thought there was something kind of fascinating about this movie in the way that, it's kind of hard to figure out whose side you're on. Ben Foster's character is very similar to Viggo Mortensen in Captain Fantastic in certain ways.
It's true, which could hurt this movie.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is,
although that movie was very popular,
and also released by Blue
Pursuit, really liked it and gave him a nomination.
Same distributor too. Same distributor, but the Ben Foster character is, I mean, the thing is, Viggo Mortensen's character goes through a certain transition in that movie, and the Ben Foster character is sort of, whatever journey he was going for has gotten to a much more advanced stage in a way. And so it's...
Well, he's a wounded, basically, he's a veteran who hasn't been able to heal.
And he's a broken man, but so very confident.
He's raising his daughter in the wilderness, partly because he can't handle society.
Exactly. So a lot of that stuff is sort of internalized, and it's a harder thing to kind of get people involved in, although I suppose maybe there's a veteran's angle to it that may draw people, but it doesn't seem like they're marketing the film in that way.
No, I don't know about that. I'll be curious to see how it does. Another movie that's actually likely to be more popular, and I have to say, you know, this is an interesting trend at the box office, which is that the documentaries are doing better than the narrative releases. So Three Identical Strangers, which was a doc hit at Sundance, even if it's not honestly one of the groundbreaking documentaries of all time in terms of its execution, the story itself is so compelling that I know it's going to do well with audiences.
Yeah, it's true. The movie is just okay, but it's this bizarre tale that some people may remember about these triplets who were separated at birth, and that particular side of the story that made them famous is just one small piece of a vast conspiratorial drama about why.
Yes, it gets more and more interesting.
Yeah, it's almost sci-fi.
Yeah, it's really weird.
Yeah,
sort of like that. It's sort of like that Wormwood documentary by Morris.
It's true. It's like, but the thing is, after I saw this movie, I did some research on it. The movie kind of makes it seem like a lot of this stuff is new. A lot of it is not new. But if you haven't heard of this case, which most people haven't, you're going to go down that wormhole and basically start searching about this stuff. And it does, I think, a pretty good job of kind of leading you through the different steps of all this stuff. And it's a great observation that documentaries are doing so well. And the question is why? Well, we live in these really bizarro times that everybody's trying to sort out. And on some level, it seems like movies that are actually dealing with the real world or trying to make sense of it or explain it, whether it's how the hell somebody could be as nice as Mr. Rogers or whatever happened in this laboratory with these triplets, it is actually more compelling on some level than what, you know, a traditional drama with some good actors could offer people. So that's kind of neat in a way.
It's just, you know, we've been observing for years that the best movies at Sundance are docs, and it seems like the public is beginning to catch up to the same reality, and there's more and more funding and more people making them, and it, you know, it just starts to, I mean, I saw like three documentaries this week that I hadn't had time to see at Sundance, and they were all good.
Yeah, it's overwhelming.
You know, so we will catch up with those anon. But in the meantime, the other movie opening this weekend is the sequel to Sicario. Now, you may remember that Denis Villeneuve and Roger Deakins and Emily Blunt were part of the first one. Well, the second one has a new director, Salima from Italy, and a new star, you know, someone like Catherine Keener is the CIA boss, but it inhabits the same world, and it's sort of like being in a television context where you have series instead of, you know, you have Patrick Melrose playing out, you know, or Little Women or Howard's End in a few episodes. And this is the same kind of thing where they can just continue the story with some of the same characters in the same world. And I thought they did a good job with it. I'm curious. I bet it does well this weekend.
You know, I've seen the movie twice, not because...
Why
did
you go a second time? That's interesting to me.
Primarily because I had a friend who loved the first one, who really wanted to see it, and I took him. But I concluded after I saw it and I was mixed on it that there was still enough to it that I would be okay watching it again, because I found the filmmaking to be very involving. And we talked about this before, but there's something that it irks me, but I'm still kind of comfortable with it, is sort of aping the style of the first film in a very blatant way. So the really intense dramatic sequences are so blatantly manipulative in a way that I found to be very involving, almost like in a B movie way. Like, there's some ludicrous stuff that happens in this movie, and I won't spoil it, but it was still very entertaining. And the fact that it was in the confines of a movie that's about such a pressing issue for society right now, irrespective of how it comes across politically, makes it incredibly watchable. So I was kind of into it in that sense, and I do enjoy the dynamic between the characters, and I'll keep watching it, even though I didn't think it was quite as sophisticated as the original one. But
fair enough. And we should point out that Taylor Sheridan wrote them both, yeah. And I'd be very curious to see if this one does well, which I think it will, how whether he would do another yeah. one. But you finally caught up with Ocean's 8. What did you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting point of comparison. Another movie that is a sequel of sorts, although in this case with original characters. I guess what surprised me about Ocean's 8 is how much I just kind of enjoyed it all the way through. It didn't stick with me, of course. It's almost like a movie that was designed to be forgettable. But people who say that Ocean's 8 is super underwhelming or whatever seem to forget that Ocean's 13 was, like, not a great movie. Like, if I were to rank them, this one's definitely ahead of that one. And maybe even ahead of
Ocean's
12.
I would agree with that.
Ocean's 12, which had some, like, fun
like
messing
that.
Around in a way. But this one, I think what's kind of neat about it is that it takes the heist formula and it just kind of delivers on it in a way where it's just like, if you like the style, it's there. There's nothing problematic.
But it's the same thing. It's the same thing as Sicario in a way, in the sense that you're inhabiting the same world. In other words, there are and the same genre, and there the rules of the formula, and you've got a group of pretty well known actors, with a good sense of comedy participating in the heist, but you really don't have any of the characters from the other one. You have mentions of Danny Ocean,
yeah.
And that's it.
But I thought that was kind of funny, because, like, he's sort of this phantom character, but you don't need him. You keep wondering, you're going to hear his voice or something like that, but why? You don't need they've given us Sandra Bullock, who to me I thought was really well cast in this part. She is in many ways the had sort of the equivalent to Danny
Absolutely.
Ocean.
Absolutely. She's driving the narrative.
And then Kate Blanchett, I mean, that's a really potent combo there. The chemistry delivers.
It's good.
It's just fun to watch them. I mean, it's not like the movie goes anywhere really interesting. The ending is
Anne Hathaway is funny, though.
Anne Hathaway has a good time. I just felt like if I was sort of, hanging out in an installation version of this thing, I'd want to just, like, roam from room to room and watch these ladies talk about stuff, because that's kind of where the essence of the movie is. And then the kind of the neat and completely outrageous way in which they concoct this heist, is there exactly the way you would expect it to be. Things are revealed and there's payoff that's hard to buy, but nevertheless kind of funny. And I think there is something really fascinating about the relationship that Sandra Bullock's character has off screen to her brother Danny Ocean, that's kind of hinted at in a way, and it leaves the door open for more movies. And it's also kind of fascinating to think about it in the context of what people are so used to with TV shows. TV shows tend to overstay their welcome, right? You hit on something good, and then you just, like, keep going and going until the thing runs out of steam. But a great movie sequel,
sometimes going for too long.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? No, but this is what I was saying before. It's the same point. It's the idea that in the movies, one of the great horrors for most studios is that they would spend a fortune on a brand new original movie and have to market it and establish a brand and get people to come and see it, and then it could die and no one will come, and everything is lost. But if they have something that they already know people like, which is the whole principle of sequels, they can extend it, and this way they can continue to play the game. Now we're seeing what goes wrong with Solo if you pick the wrong thing, but it makes the studios much more comfortable to be able to, and that's why TV is burgeoning and flourishing, is because they don't have to worry about this. They can just keep going with all of these worlds, and the Marvel universe can keep going.
Yeah,
with
but
all
I think
these
with the
worlds.
Contrast that's kind of interesting there is that with the movies. So the Marvel Universe is one example, and these movies are doing it on a totally different scale, but you do have kind of the opportunity to take a breather, find a different angle, give audience a lot of time to kind of anticipate this thing, and then give them 2 hours that have to be substantial in a way that delivers for a long period of time. Whereas with the TV show, you have a much more expansive opportunities, and it's kind of interesting to look at the contrast between these two different storytelling techniques, because, you know, it's, I don't think like turning the Oceans franchise into a TV series would make much sense, but
no,
every
no,
couple of years is fine.
Like, and you want the scale, and you want the luxuriousness, and you want the music and all that good stuff.
And you get tired of it after a while if it happened every week.
Well, let's talk about Westworld, which just concluded. The finale was this past week. Now, I hung in there through these different seasons, and I've managed to stay engaged. I managed to stay engaged to the very end of this. You have been watching these too. And by the way, anyone who's listening, if you haven't seen the Westworld finale, spoiler alert.
I guess so. There's so much to unpack that it's hard to figure out what constitutes a spoiler in this thing. It's the weirdness of the editing.
If you understand it in the first place.
I felt that it was
sort of
like,
hard to give it away because it's inexplicable.
I felt like it was actually more straightforward than a lot of people seem to be describing it. It's just that it was edited in a non-linear fashion that throws you off, and you know, that's kind of cool. I wasn't on board with some of the deaths that happened, particularly with a human character that I thought didn't need to sacrifice himself. But even the people now in Westworld could come back in some capacity. And the thing I thought that was really cool about it was that one thing that really delivered here is the first season was all build up to the finale at the end. And this one really, really does a good job of completely changing up the world all over again. Like at the end of the first season, it's like Westworld being, you know, the hosts, the robots are rebelling, and that's one thing. But if you just stayed with that premise indefinitely, it would get tiring.
They definitely had a wrinkle, which was to explain A, what the man in black was up to all this time, and B, what the corporate villains were trying to achieve, and it relates very clearly to the world that we're paranoid about now.
Oh, sure, and also
cyber,
as does the
warfare and hacking and all the stealing of information that's going on.
Well, yeah, the way that information travels in this world. I mean, the fact of the matter is that we don't know exactly how many people or how many hosts are now sort of unleashed in the real world, but they're out there and they're operating in a way that is kind of beyond what we can totally understand. And I think that part of it's kind of fascinating too. It's almost like a Julian Assange WikiLeaks style operation or something, and potentially giving Tessa Thompson the opportunity to step up and be the actual main character of the show, although we'll see exactly
how they resolve that
side of things develops. But it's cool.
It's a little bit like the Marvel world too,
yeah,
where there've been all these deaths, all these kill-offs, and the real who's really dead and who's really going to be able to continue. I think that's an interesting question.
Yeah, no, it's cool. I mean, it's a very cinematic show, and I think they're doing a great job of it. And it totally belongs on TV with the kind of production budget that they're being given at this particular moment, and not, you know, as a movie. I mean, it already was a movie a long time ago, but this is
it's very cinematic, and, yeah, and it's got lots of movie actors in it, and it looks good. Altered Carbon is another one that played this year. I don't know if you saw it. It's not nearly as good.
Yeah, I watched a little bit of it. Yeah,
Joel Kinnaman was in it, but it too played around with these ideas of who's real and whose body can be replaced by another body, and where is the original? You know, people are throwing these data packs brains around, you know, throwing them in their pocket. But I enjoyed it. I did. I wasn't satisfied by the ending. It's not like I was totally, oh, great, you know. But it was compelling throughout, and I'll take it.
Yeah, sometimes that's all you got to do. So next week, I hope you get a chance to see Ant-Man and the Wasp. I've been holding my tongue about it this week, but there's much to discuss.
I'm debating it. It's really interesting. This week I had to choose between going to see the press screening of Ant-Man and the Wasp and going to the premiere that HBO threw for Sharp Objects, which stars Amy Adams in a big high-level Gillian Flynn, Jean-Marc Vallée, you know, extravaganza with Patricia Clarkson as her mother, and it's very edgy and fun. And I chose that because I'd heard it was really good. I have to tell you, true confession, I didn't like the first Ant-Man. If I were doing a ranking of all the Marvel titles, by the way, I'm a huge fan of these Marvel movies. I like almost all of them. This would be the one at the bottom of the list. It's lightweight. I don't respond to Paul Rudd. There's something about it that I never liked.
But don't
liked.
Forget, this is Ant-Man and the Wasp, so you got Evangeline Lilly sort of having a more prominent role this time.
I'm curious.
I have mixed feelings about the movie. I hope you check it out, because then we have things to talk about. And it will be a major release, obviously, next week. Of course, we can also talk about a lot of other stuff, because it's a crowded marketplace, especially in our world.
Bye-bye.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com, and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.